Take us with you on your Apple CarPlay or Android Auto through your iHeartRadio app. It's Ottawa Now with Christy Cameron on News Talk 580 CFRA and the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
If we're at a point where one or two sick calls makes a department have to close, this tells you how extreme the shortage is in Ontario. But this shortage is happening during the winter, during the fall, during the spring. It is happening at all times of year. So we are seeing that these are closures that are as a result of the staffing crisis in Ontario's hospitals.
That is Erin Aris, the provincial president of the Ontario Nurses Association, speaking with CTV Ottawa yesterday about staffing shortages. As we head into another summer, it is top of mind for hospitals in our region. And we already told you about the Kentville District Hospital. They're borrowing ER doctors from us in Ottawa. They might soon be borrowing nurses if they can figure it out. Otherwise, they were going to have to shut down on weekends for 3 months, pretty much all summer. The Arnprior Regional Hospital was forced to close its emergency room Monday night for the second time this month. Joining us right now, Lee Levesque, who's the CEO of Arnprior Regional Health. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Happy to be here with you, Christy.
Give us a snapshot of what is happening inside the healthcare system, inside that hospital, that led to the closure on Monday night.
So as you can imagine, the health human resource shortage has been many years in the making. And more so over the last 2 years as a result of the pandemic, nurses leaving the profession, nurses who are working excessive hours as a result to cover off those shifts and illness, those certainly led to, for us, unexpected last-minute staffing shortages. And we've been working actually quite hard to try and avoid the closures at ARH. We've put a number of strategies in place over the last 2 years to ensure that we are able to provide the service to our community.
Do you think this is going to continue to happen this summer?
We've been working both internally and externally with our partners to try and ensure we've got ongoing resources. We're optimistic that this was a unusual expectation, but we can't commit that this, if we don't have the staff, we can't safely provide care. So there is potential there could be further closures, but that is not on our short-term radar.
How do you communicate that when you have to make the tough decision for an overnight temporary closure to get the word out, Lee, so that people aren't showing up at the hospital potentially in a crisis where they need immediate medical help and no one's there to take them?
Yeah, so we do always have a physician in the building. Our challenge was not having any nursing staff to be able to provide the care or the treatment that the physicians prescribe. We do work quite well with our regional hospital partners and also with Renfrew County EMS. So they do provide for us paramedics who are actually on site external to the building. So they actually have a vehicle here where they can redirect anybody that requires immediate medical assistance, and through the 911 system, they can either triage the patients over the phone and refer them to the Renfrew County Virtual Triage and Assessment Clinic for follow-up the subsequent day, or transfer them immediately to either closest hospital, which for us has been Renfrew and Elmont.
Lee, when you described the position the hospital is in right now, it sounded very much to me like because you're dealing with burnout and sickness and just a lack of people, workers leaving the profession, that this is essentially week by week. Is that a fair assessment?
I would suggest I think this for us was a one-off. I think we just had some extenuating circumstances that put us in that position. We've been monitoring over the last many months, and we continue to plan as we move forward. And I'm optimistic that it was a one-time instance, but the bigger concern is this is not just an ARH problem. I think everybody is fully aware this is a provincial and national problem where there aren't enough resources to be able to provide the care for the communities in which the hospitals are trying to do so.
But you know firsthand from your time working as a nurse what this looks like. And realistically, if already the hospital is struggling, if burnout is already a factor when more people are off sick, you're also managing potentially summer vacation, people leaving the profession, that really does exacerbate the problem, doesn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely does. But we've been very innovative, actually. We've been partnering with the Renfrew County paramedics who provide triage coverage for us in the hospital, and they provide a fair bit of service for us, and that alleviates the challenge with not having enough staff. It's, you know, you always like to have your full complement of registered nurses, but given our current environment, that's not possible. We've also been using agency staff, which comes at a higher expense, but these are all things that we've invested in to ensure that we're able to continue to offer the services for our community. So we continue to recruit. We've got a number of, you know, incentives where there's $25,000 incentive for anybody to come with a 2-year return of service. We've got what we call clinical externs, and these are third and fourth year nursing students who are working to help support the registered staff in the departments and are able to provide some minimum care. And our foundation's been very generous in supporting what we call a bridging program. We're trying to grow our own. So some of our RPNs have applied to go back to RN to get their RNs, and they are getting their tuition covered through our foundation. So, again, you know, a return on investment for them to provide 2 years of service when their program completes. So we've been trying to mitigate this, but unfortunately just came to a crisis this month for us.
How many people are you trying to recruit?
We're trying to recruit around 6 to 7 registered staff for our emergency department, and that varies between both full-time and part-time positions.
Will people be able to take any breaks this summer if they have scheduled time off, or will they be called in?
No, we've mitigated that with these additional resources, and we will be shoring up more paramedic services on a longer basis, and so we are really optimistic that that is going to help us through the summer. Our staff really do need their time off. I think, you know, they've been working extra hours, and I think that in itself contributes to them not being well, but also, you know, needing some time off. It's not healthy for anybody to work excessive hours that they've been supporting us to do.
Thank you very much. We'll check back in.
Okay. Thank you very much, Christy.
Lee Levesque, who's the CEO of Arnprior Regional Health. 418. You bring me, then I
bring my rules. Last time this is Ottawa Now with Christy Cameron on News Talk 580 CFRA and the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
A class action lawsuit is alleging that Shopify reneged on a deal that it offered some employees who were laid off in a recent round of cuts. This is a class action lawsuit, so none of these allegations have been tested in court. But an employee has hired a law firm and is now getting other people, a former employee, getting other people to sign on, saying that he was laid off at the start of May, that people were presented with departure packages outlining hefty severance sums that they would be entitled to should they sign the agreement within a few days. And the allegation is that didn't happen. The allegation is that once workers signed the agreements before the deadline passed, that Shopify allegedly told the departing staff they would instead be given something that was substantially smaller. Employment lawyer Lior Samfiru, who's the national co-managing partner with Samfiru Tamarkin LLP, is the lawyer that has been hired in this case. And he was on the Morning Rush with Bill Carroll earlier today. Bill asked him how he got involved in the lawsuit.
We've commenced this class action after being contacted by dozens of Shopify employees over the past couple of weeks. We're spearheading it for the exact reasons that you said. Shopify breached the severance agreements with many of its employees across Canada.
Has that come up very often in all your years as an employment lawyer?
So, Bill, this year it's going to be 21 years for me doing this, and I've seen many things, as you can imagine. I have not seen this situation where an employer offers, mind you, not fantastic offers, reasonable offers, what you would expect to see. Having employees accept it only then to say, no, no, sorry, not going to happen. We're going to pay you tens of thousands of dollars less. Never seen that, never thought I would see that. And the reason why I haven't seen it, it's obvious. You simply can't do that. It doesn't work that way. We call this a contract. There's an offer, there's an acceptance. You can't decide that you don't want to pay it no more than the employee who accepted the offer could have said, you know what, I now realize I could have gotten more money from you, employer, so I'm going to now go get that more money. Can't do that. Contract is a contract.
So this is why you tell people who are being let go, don't sign anything yet until you get legal advice.
Well, the interesting thing is, before this whole situation happened, after these terminations and layoffs were announced earlier in the month, we had a lot of Shopify employees contact us to review their severance packages. You've heard me say this before. You've talked about it, that in the majority of cases, the offers that I see are not good. They need improvement. They need negotiation. Well, we were pleasantly surprised to see it with respect to many of these Shopify employees that, you know what? This offer is within the range that we would want to see. You're the exception. So, yeah, we told many employees, we are comfortable telling you, you can go ahead and sign this. And they did, and only for then that to happen. So I guess my original thesis that I always go by, that offers are often inadequate, still applies here, except in this case, they can't get away with it. It's just not going to work that way.
So how far short was the actual check compared to what they believed they were getting?
So we've seen anywhere from 8,000 to 60,000. Our lead plaintiff in this class action, his name is Mr. Russell, Ian Russell. The shortfall for him is just somewhere north of $50,000. So it's a significant
amount. Well, that's a big difference.
Oh, my gosh. And again, this was not a situation where this was a windfall. Oh, my God, there's a typo there. So because of that, I'm going to get all this money that I'm not owed. None of that happened here. He was made an offer, which was a reasonable one. It was reasonable to have made it. It was reasonable for him to have accepted it. And now they're saying it's going to be $50,000 less. No, we're simply not going to be able to accept that.
So was each employee's amount actually in their agreement?
Absolutely, yes. If you sign this agreement,
so the dollars and cents are part of the agreement they signed.
The dollars and cents to the penny. So every
It signed by management?
Yes.
So yes, it was. You got a signed agreement that includes the dollar amount between management and the employee. Everyone has signed off on it. It's in writing. How do they have a case at all? I don't understand. Aren't they just going to lose this?
Well, you and I we may have different experience when it comes to law, but we're in agreement here that it doesn't take a legal expert to understand that when there's an offer with a dollar amount saying, in order to accept this offer, you have to do the following things. You have to sign this document, you have to sign that document, and you have to do it all by this date. Once an employee does that, abides by those terms of acceptance, there is a contract. And yes, I agree completely. It's not something that, in our view, not only can they do that, that they can actually win on. And because of that, it's our hope that even though there's this class action here, we're not going to have to. That's the hope, to litigate this long term, that they're going to want to do the right thing legally and then, frankly, from a fairness standpoint to their employees, and want to resolve this, acknowledge their mistake, and simply pay what they've agreed to pay.
Employment lawyer Lior Sanfiru. Well, you know what? I've been involved in a few personal legal situations, and I've covered a lot of these stories. It never stops amazing me, though, that no matter how clear something looks on the surface, you'll find a lawyer who'll come up with an argument. Have they countered this? Do they have some explanation for this? Something in the fine print that they can say, you also agreed that under these circumstances, you might take less?
Well, so far, we have not yet received a response. This class action just hasn't been launched within the last 24 hours. I'm very interested and curious to see what that response is. Happy to come talk to you about it once that happens. The only thing I can imagine is they'll say, well, we miscalculated. We didn't intend to pay you or to offer you this much. But again, that is not a valid defense, not even close. So I whatever the issue was, would have been an internal issue. Maybe someone gets fired at Shopify for making a mistake, if in fact it was a mistake. None of that should impact the rights of these employees.
So if someone listening right now is an ex-Shopify employees, is it, can they get involved in this class action?
So any employee where this happened to them, where they accepted an offer only to then have Shopify renege on the offer, those employees are automatically included as part of the class action. There will be an opportunity at some point to opt out of the class action for those that do not want any part of it, but there's no need at this time to register, to sign up. You're included if this happened to you, and you will have that opportunity at some point to opt out.
The Ottawa reached out to Shopify. They did not request, they did not respond, rather, to a request for comment. That's Lior Samfiro, who is the lawyer on that case. It is 4:29. We'll take a short break. We're about a half an hour away from our question of the day. Have you noticed noise levels going up to a jarring level in your neighborhood? Is it disturbing you? Have you made noise to your neighbor about the noise? Have you raised it as a problem or a conflict? I'd love to hear from you. I don't find my neighborhood very noisy, but then I wonder if maybe I'm the noisy one. That's coming up. And on the other side, Stephen Blais, who used to be an Ottawa City Councillor, now an Orleans MPP, wants to push through changes so that we can kick out misbehaving city councillors, but his bill has failed. That's next.
Just dancing with my eyes closed.
Welcome back to Ottawa Now with Christy Cameron on News Talk 580 CFRA and the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Welcome back to Ottawa Now. An Ottawa MPP's attempt to have a bill go through that would kick out misbehaving city councillors was debated last night and failed today. Orleans MPP Stephen Blais, who will join us momentarily, actually used to be an Ottawa City Councillor. And so he saw firsthand what was going on at Ottawa City Council. Former Ottawa City Councillor Rick Shirelli was still sitting despite all of the allegations against him, because under the current rules, while he was docked pay for 15 months, while there were two Integrity Commissioner reports that found he harassed former staff members and people that were applying to work within his office, they could not kick him out. They can only actually lose their seats, lose their jobs, if they break the spending rules for elections and for certain conflict of interest policies. So the most severe thing they could do was yank his pay. And it was quite a bit of pay, but he stayed on until the end, until the election. And even then, he said that he was considering running. When he decided not to run, he said the reason he didn't run was that he thought he would win and that it would be too difficult for his family. So this attempt has happened before. In fact, Stephen Blais first introduced this bill in March of last year. It didn't pass a third reading before the election was called. Here's a bit of the debate that was going on yesterday and today. Here's MPP Charmaine Williams, who's the Associate Minister of Women's Social and Economic Opportunity of Ontario, explaining why she wasn't going to vote in favor of this bill.
Now, I appreciate the essence of the bill. However, I am concerned with the consequences that will occur if this bill was to go forward. You know, this bill might drop the guard that is in place with our Municipal Act, so much so that women who are elected to council tables are at risk of losing their spot if they speak out against their council colleagues.
Stephen Blais joins us right now. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Christy.
That was a snippet of the debate last night, and they formally killed this today. What is your reaction to it?
The line from the minister is complete bollocks. You know, I had the pleasure of serving with some strong women on Ottawa City Council. You've covered them for years, Diane Deans, Jan Harder, just to name a few. They were passionate advocates for their community and for the issues that they cared about the most. And no one would have mistook their passionate debate at city council or even in private meetings as some form of harassment. So to suggest that harassment would be leveled against strong female candidates and having a process to then remove those people from office would lead to women losing their positions on councils is just 100% bollocks. And I think that's what is the most frustrating about this entire process.
But Stephen Blake, could your bill be leveraged in some way unfairly to target or push out a politician who people just don't like?
I don't think so, because we included a judicial review in the bill. So right now, as you know, Christy, if there is a complaint about harassment or some kind of assault or abuse, an integrity commissioner can investigate that. That's what happens today. That's what happened with Mr. Shirelli and has happened in too many cities across the province. And that integrity commissioner makes recommendations to council. What my bill does is says one of those recommendations he or she is allowed to make is termination of your job. And instead of giving it to councillors to use as a political weapon and just say, okay, yeah, they're kicked off a council. If that recommendation is made, then it goes to a judge. And you have to demonstrate in front of a judge that not only did the bad behavior happen, but the bad behavior was so severe that it would require you to lose your job. I think we can all agree that there are things that people do at work that are inappropriate, but maybe don't, you know, you're not going to get fired over every little inappropriate thing. Some things rise to the level of losing your job. What happened here in Ottawa, what happened in Brampton, in Barrie, in Mississauga, and in frankly too many other places across the province. Having someone who is passionate about their community debating for the issues that matter most to them and making an argument in public, that's what democracy is. That's not going to lead you to lose your job. If the minister is concerned about abuse, that abuse can happen today. And the fact of the matter is, it's just not taking place because we know that debate is part of democracy. What is taking place is that some elected officials are abusing their power. They're psychologically, emotionally, sometimes physically tormenting and abusing their staff, their colleagues, you know, potential for constituents. And that's wrong. And they should lose their jobs when those things happen.
Losing 15 months of pay is a pretty huge blow. You have to pay your bills. That's money that's not coming in, even though you're still doing the job. Explain to some people who might be opposed to this, Stephen Blake, why sanctioning the pay doesn't go far enough.
Well, again, there are some actions that are so bad that you should lose your job. I don't know what the penalty structure is like at CTV, but I imagine there's a range of penalties that can be imposed on employees at CTV for types of behavior, the final of which is losing your job. Yes, Mr.
Thankfully, Shirelli, I haven't had to find that out, so I'm not familiar.
Exactly. But, you know, Mr. Shirelli lost some pay. And, you know, I think if you look by his attendance at council, it's questionable whether or not he actually continued to do his job. He also received a severance when he chose not to run again. If I remember correctly, the severance was something like 8 months' pay he would have gotten in a lump sum when he chose not to run. He was also accumulating pensionable service for his gold-plated Omer's pension. And so these are the kinds of things that continued to be accumulated and continued to happen while he maintained his position. And remember, elected officials have a position of authority and respect in our community. And I don't know that we want people who conduct themselves in that way to really be maintaining that authority and respect and to be continuing to be able to purport themselves as representing our community. My final point on that, Christy, will be that irrespective of the impact that it had on his victims, which was traumatic and life-altering, this situation that took place effectively meant that the residents of College Ward were unrepresented for almost 3.5 years. Rick had no influence at City Hall.
I heard that time and time again, right? On the show. So I'm not going to argue with you on that. But to the final question here, this was killed before the last provincial election. Now it's been killed again. Now what?
Well, so 150 municipalities have asked the government to introduce this type of either this legislation specifically or this type of legislation. The Women of Ontario Say No is a group that formed around this issue. They're continuing to make deputations to city councils, and we're going to continue to put pressure. I know that the Minister of Municipal Affairs wants to see something like this happen. How do I know that? Because he's told me, because he's been on the public record saying so. He has a bill ready to go. This was stopped by the Premier and the House Leader. For some reason, the premier and the House leader don't want to have accountability at Municipal City Hall. So we're going to continue to put the pressure on. I'm hoping that over time, Minister Clark will do the right thing and bring his own bill forward. I will be the biggest champion for that bill when he brings it forward, because this wasn't a partisan issue. It's never been a partisan issue, and it shouldn't be a partisan issue going forward.
Stephen Blais, thank you.
Thank you, Christy.
Orleans MPP Stephen Blais joining me on the show. 448, could using ketamine be the solution for people who suffer from severe depression when other drugs and more traditional forms of treatment have failed? The Royal is doing this. They just opened up a new innovative depression clinic yesterday. And they're testing this. They're giving patients a form of ketamine. We'll chat with one of the researchers next. Baby, show me you can
calm down, calm down. Join the conversation on Ottawa Now with Christy Cameron. Text 580-580 right now.
A new clinic at the Royal Institute of Mental Health Research is giving patients a form of ketamine as an option to treat severe depression. Esketamine is a form of ketamine, a drug which is widely used as a form of anesthesia, and it's now being used at this innovative new depression clinic. The clinic just opened up yesterday, and it's supported by a historic $2 million donation from BMO. Jennifer Phillips is on the line right now, the interim scientific director of the Royal's Institute for Mental Health Research. Hello, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
How is this drug used to treat severe depression?
So this is a, as you mentioned, this is a form of ketamine that is administered as a nasal spray under medical supervision. And it's actually a very small, much smaller dose of ketamine. It's called a sub-anesthetic dose that's used to treat depression. And we administer that here at the Royal in our clinic. And patients are able to stay on their oral antidepressant medication or continue their psychotherapy alongside this treatment.
Who would be a candidate for this? As I understand it, it's people who have tried other forms of medication and other approaches that don't seem to be working.
Exactly. About 30% of individuals with depression find that their symptoms do not improve even when they've tried multiple conventional medications. So these are the individuals with difficult to treat depression or treatment resistant depression who really are good candidates potentially for trying esketamine.
How do you give them the ketamine?
So it's a nasal spray that they actually self-administer, but they do so at our clinic in the Royal. So it's a simple nasal spray like you might see for allergies or something like that. But the side effects include a potential small rise in blood pressure, a little bit of dissociation, which is feeling sort of a distortion in your perception, possibly feeling a little disconnected. So it's important that this is done with physicians and nursing staff accompanying them.
What actually happens inside the body? How does it differ from the traditional methods of treating depression? And why do you think it can help these people?
So this is still an area of active research to understand exactly how it elicits its antidepressant effects. But what is clear is that it's targeting a different neurotransmitter system, so different chemicals and receptors in the brain compared to conventional antidepressant treatments. And what's key is that it is able to rapidly increase something called neuroplasticity, which is the brain's ability to form new connections and new pathways. And we think this may support recovery from depression.
I'm really fascinated by this work. It's very interesting, but I am getting some text messages of people saying, right, but this is a drug and the person is getting high. Isn't that what ketamine does? What would your response be to that?
I think that's a common misconception, actually, that might be how it's eliciting its effects. In fact, the side effects I mentioned, dissociation, what you're calling getting high, those generally tend to relieve or diminish within a few hours of the dosing. And the maximal effects we see are actually the next day, the next couple days. So the antidepressant effects really last a lot longer than the side effects that we would see with this medication.
What do you see the next day and beyond?
Well, this is where people who have potentially been ill for several years, who have tried other treatments and are really not seeing a release of their symptoms, are seeing a decrease in their depressive symptoms, sometimes a decrease in anxiety, Definitely seeing effects on suicidal thoughts, which generally can be decreased in people who are responding well. So we're seeing that there's an ability maybe to engage more in their activities, in their lives, the things that we tend to lose when experiencing depression.
Where do you want to take this research next?
Well, that's really the key, I think, is the fact that the BMO Innovative Clinic for Depression, our new clinic, is located at the Royal and Academic Hospital. So we have the combined expertise and experience to be able to integrate research into the provision of care. So we're able to really take this further than just delivering a treatment. We're translating this esketamine, which was formerly only available in clinical trials, we're translating that into clinical practice. And there's a lot of unanswered questions that remain. So it's really important that we're able to offer this as a comprehensive treatment alongside their other therapies or medications that they're undergoing for their depression, but that we're also able to combine that with research. That could
Thanks so much, Jennifer.
Imaging. Oh, thank you.
No, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so some of the things in the future, combining this with brain imaging, combining esketamine with psychotherapy, and looking at physical health and the links between physical health and mental health and how that affects a person's response to treatment.
Thanks, Jennifer. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Jennifer Phillips, who is the interim scientific director of the Royal's Institute for Mental Health Research. They just opened thanks to a $2 million donation from BMO, and they're looking at newer innovative treatments for people that have severe depression, including this type of ketamine. 5 p.m., the question of the day is coming up next.